We're not here just to win an election. We are here to win something for our country.
Welcome to the Water Cooler podcast from the Menzies Research Centre. I'm Nick Cato, a senior fellow at the Menzies Research Centre. In this particular series of Water Cooler podcasts, we're attempting to do something big, to define the virtues that unite Australian Liberals in the 21st century. The True Believer series, as we're calling it, is a forum for free-ranging, intelligent discussion that we hope will promote a broader conversation about the ideas that bind us as a political movement and how they can solve today's policy challenges. Our starting point is the We Believe statement, issued to mark the 10th anniversary of the Liberal Party in 1954. Each week we examine one of the 17 We Believe statements to try and discover the abiding liberal virtues they contain, and then ask another question. If that statement was to be written today, would the 1954 version be retained as it is, revised or rejected? And I'm delighted to say that each week we have a distinguished guest to help us do the intellectual heavy lifting, which brings me to the office of Nick Greiner, who served as the 37th Premier of New South Wales from 1988 to 1992. He's a former federal president of the Liberal Party and recently completed an assignment as the Australian Consul General in New York. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Nick, and welcome to my office.
Nick, before we get into the text for today, just on that general thing we're trying to do, to distill the essence of liberal thought into words that mean something but could nonetheless be embraced by everybody in the party. Now, you're a former party president. You'd know how wide and diverse the range of views are, different ages. Some people from the country, some people from the city, whole range of reasons why they may have a different perspective. Do you think what we're doing is mission impossible?
Well, no, I wouldn't be here if I thought it was mission impossible. I think it's important for any organisation, and in this case the Liberal Party of Australia, to have a clear understanding of where it came from, of its origins, if you like, and certainly Menzies' speech, of which was then reproduced in 1954, is a fundamental part of the party. So I think the worst thing we could do is try and find why that's irrelevant. I think indeed we need to understand it and take it forward. I think the taking it forward part is where I'm occasionally critical of the party that I've been involved in since 1980, and that is where we tend to easily fall into taking what was said 60, 70, whatever years ago, and not working through how the party needs to implement it, what the context is, how the context has changed, if it's changed. It usually has changed over three quarters of a century. And how the definition, the things we're going to talk about, how they fit with my view and I think Sir Robert Menzies' view, that at the end of the day, this is about winning, which doesn't mean you say stupid things or that you say things you don't believe in just to try and win an extra vote. But it does mean, and I think it applies to the religions, the Christian religions in Australia at the moment, it applies to a lot of organisations that have had a long history, that I think you do need to have an open discussion in the party about both the original meanings, which is roughly what we're doing, and then what is the context, how has it changed, and how appealing is that notion in the different context. I think it remains appealing in terms of our discussion today, in fact very appealing. But yeah, I'm interested in the implementation of what you're trying or what the Menzies Centre is trying to do and how that fits with resurrecting our winning ways in Australian politics, in the 2020s and, dare I say it, even the 2030s.
Well, just to give you some reassurance that we are doing something useful here, Nick. Looking back to your time, I suppose particularly as as leader in the party, in the parliamentary party, you would have had many occasions, surely, in the party room where there's disagreement, often heated disagreement. Is it helpful at times like that to refer back to first principles and say, well, at least we all believe that business is better at creating jobs than government, or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is fundamental that you have, I like to call it the Ten Commandments, if you like, transmogrified into a political party. And it is helpful to the leader, and it's challenging. We're not all that good at ideas, discussions. We tend to go with the politician's gut feel, and it tends to be very short-term, very current. And you understand why that's happening, but I'm certainly not thinking that this exercise is a waste of time. Indeed, on the contrary, at this moment in our political history as the Liberal Party of Australia, this is exactly what we should be doing.
Well, let me read the clause which we're going to interrogate today, and then I'll tell you why we're really keen to get you on to talk about it. We believe in the individual. We stand positively for the free man, his initiative, individuality, and acceptance of responsibility. When my colleague David Hughes and I were thinking who we might invite along for this, we thought, well, it would be great to get somebody who's got at least some experience or some family history of living in a society that isn't as free as ours, where these things, the freedom of the individual can't be taken for granted. So, of course, you have just such a background. You were born in Budapest, I think 2 years after the end of World War II, in what, from my reading of history, was a brief interlude between the end of the Nazis and the real arrival of communism. Tell me, what do you remember of anything from that period, and a bit about your family's experience?
I think I'd be telling giant fibs if I said I remembered a lot of my 8 months in Budapest, or indeed my subsequent 2.5 years in Vienna before we came to Australia. But in a sense, I have a throwback view, because clearly my parents were greatly... I was going to say impressed, that's not the word, greatly affected by what happened to them. I think my father's family lost their second fortune. They lost one in about 1918 when there was an earlier communist government, and they lost one in that interlude, or basically when the communists came to replace the fascists, who would also have lost them their fortune if they'd stayed. So I think my parents, people of that sort, and you could say the same about Vietnamese refugees, for example, who were 30-odd years later, I think they have a broader and perhaps a more grounded view, because unlike Australians, for which it's a bit of a, can be a bit of an academic exercise, a bit of a, well, we believe in the right to say what we like or worship what we like or whatever it might be. My parents, this changed their lives in an absolutely transcendental way. I mean, they were lucky that it didn't change their lives by eliminating the family that they had just started. But beyond that, they clearly not only had lost, their economic well-being, which the family and my father's family had worked on for many, many decades, but it was more that the society was not just one where their reward for effort, where their economic well-being was challenged, but it was certainly a broader... it affected the society, it affected the way they lived. And my father he lived in Australia for almost 50 years after we got here. And I have to say, sadly, that apart from when I was leading the Liberal Party, he mostly voted DLP, because he wanted the most extremely anti-communist party that he could find. And I get that. I tried to talk him out of that, but that is nevertheless, I think he even handed out for the DLP before I got personally involved in Liberal Party politics. But anyway, back to your question. I think, call it migrants, call it people whose lives and countries of origin have been completely changed by parties of the extreme left or indeed the extreme right, and have had their freedom not just to make money or work in the way they wanted to, but really their fundamental way of life really dramatically changed. So that's why, I'm sorry this is a long answer, Nick, but it irks me no end that as we sit here in 2023, people of my generation that have after World War II have mostly integrated into Australian society, but we don't seem as a party to do as well as we should with the more recent migrants who've had similar experiences. They're mostly in Asia. They're Chinese, they're Vietnamese, they're Laotians. To a degree, they're Indians or people from the subcontinent. And there is something wrong with us. I don't think we can blame them, that our support from those groups whose lives have really been changed for the worst, and often that's the reason they've come to Australia, yet we seem in 2023 to be losing our relationship with them. And that frankly says something's wrong with us rather than with them.
You know, I agree with you, because the values that that we own of individual endeavour, enterprise, a free economy, the chance to get a good education for your children. These are core values, of course, for almost every migrant that comes here.
And especially their family. I mean, the Menzies, if you read, I know you have, if you read what Menzies said when he started in politics, the family was one of the things that he really insisted was one of the differentiating factors, one of the values that the Liberal Party, when he founded it, stood for. And so it's an interesting question as to why we're the party of the family and of all those virtues that you just ran through, yet we somehow don't seem to we don't seem to have the currency with our fellow Australians who believe in all those values and yet seem to vote in reasonable part for our political opponents, who clearly don't clearly don't have those values to the extent that we do.
No, it's interesting, often when you talk to Labor people, they seem to think that these are their natural voters, because I think where we see people that have come here with enormous potential, motivation, are going to make great entrepreneurs and small businessmen or whatever, they see a vulnerable minority group that needs protecting, and that, of course, is only partially true. But they seem to win that argument.
Well, they also see people who tend to gravitate in their early years to the union movement, even though the union movement is down to under 10%, I think, of the Australian workforce. But they tend to gravitate, perhaps for the same reason, the fact that people feel vulnerable, feel at risk because they've come and they don't speak the language or don't have qualification or whatever. And they see the union movement, and especially in the sort of lower socioeconomic areas, the union movement as being a defender of them. And they see the union movement giving them or helping give them the opportunities they crave. And that's, of course, I can think of a rude word to say, that's nonsense. It really is nonsense, yet somehow we, I think, have not engaged, have not, for that matter, promoted people of that background, even though they're often now well-educated and so on. We underrepresented. Mark Speakman said to me the other day that he thought one of the great weaknesses of the party he now leads in opposition in New South Wales was that I think there's one out of 18 persons of whatever you want to call it, ethnic is probably not the right word, but of ethnic background, multicultural background in the shadow cabinet, and there's only two others in the party. And that's frankly awful, just awful, because it's not as though there are no people with that set of values and no people with competence and qualifications and interest. It really needs to be, you know, something that the party sets out to do.
And we can learn from the British Conservative Party in this. Rishi Sunak, you know, is the Prime Minister, and I think it'll happen. Myself, Nick, I mean, when you get around to some of the branches, particularly in the north west of Sydney, you know, there are a lot of people, particularly Indians, who kind of get the democracy thing and want to be part of it.
So yeah. I think it is a question of time, but I'm usually impatient, and I think we need to just demonstrate, and this is not where what you and I are talking about today, but we need to demonstrate that the party sees this dilemma, call it what you like, and places a significant priority on ensuring that people who come with those values, but who may start off being vulnerable and economically challenged in their first years, that the party really recognises that and is willing to do something about it.
Yeah, and to follow on from that, to go to the values that we're talking about today from this We Believe statement, the freedom of the individual is kind of core to Menzies. It runs like a rich vein through almost everything he ever says when he gets vaguely philosophical. And so I think it's worthwhile to try and pick why. And one thing that's clearly in Menzies' head is that this is the natural human condition. He says, and this comes from his Forgotten People speech, he says, that we are all, as human beings of like value, cannot be denied. So you'd recognise that as coming from the Gospels and it's from Christian upbringing. There is a sense in which it is the natural condition for humans, isn't it? They don't want to be bossed around. They would much rather take control of their own lives.
Yeah, I think there it is a natural instinct, and that's one of the good things where you combine political success with policy success is that this is. People like to say now that so-and-so is on the right side of history or all of those expressions. I suspect that was a bit in Menzies' mind because he was not speaking just for trying to get the right pitch for the 1946 or 49 or any other election. I'm entirely sure that's... You know, that sort of not only, if you like, it's not only good basis for policy, a good basis for getting a coherent party, which is partly, I think, what your exercise is aimed at doing. It's also a way of getting a coherent party that has a set of policies grounded in those values and which are capable of being promoted in the political sense into a winning amalgam, because you know that is the name of the game, is to combine the virtues of what we believe with creating a set of values that help win elections when we're out of government by and large everywhere.
And I think the other thing that illuminates Menzies' real passion about freedom is when he talks about the dystopian opposite to this, and remembering that this was, of course, from 1954, you know, it was right in a very nasty stage of the Cold War, and we had a real enemy had a different point of view. And he said, in the Forgotten People's Feast of Speech, 1942, "I do not believe we will come out into the overlordship of an all-powerful state on whose benevolence we shall live spineless and effortless. Individual enterprise must drive us forward." No question that message still resonates today.
Yeah, well, he had a good turn of phrase. I think I and many other leaders up subsequently in the Liberal Party would have liked to have had his turn of phrase. But no, I think it does resonate, and I think it's important we not step back from that. And you can see our opponents stepping back from the converse. I mean, I was overseas for most of the last term of the federal government, of the Morrison government. I didn't think we did a great job of positioning the current Prime Minister and the party in the context of this. We allowed him to move himself, at least in a perceptual sense, towards a middle ground which fitted somewhere in what we're saying, when all of his personal beliefs and history indicated that he didn't actually believe. And you can see from what the government's now doing, not so much I think in foreign affairs, but in domestic policy, you can see what the government is doing basically in the labour market, industrial relations, things like that. And so he's moving back to where he came from. So anyway, I think that's a diversion. But I do think that we've got to make sure we own, to use I think your word earlier, we're seen to own some of these things, and that we don't let Labor, our opponents, seize them, especially when they're in opposition, because there tends to be a predictable, well-worn path. They're usually out of power because our values, especially at federal level, tend to be what people in Australia want. And then when Labor wins, for whatever range of reasons, they've usually moved to the centre to try and claim victory, which clearly they've done in Australia last year. And then they move back to the left again. It's a bit like a swing or something, and it is thoroughly predictable. And I think we occasionally, maybe even often, allow them to do that. And I think that's just bad politics, as in at the end of the day, as well as weakening one of our strengths, which is that we have this corpus of ideas, which are the basis for being a very successful party. I mean, the evidence supports that.
So I agree. I think we should be more direct in our language and calling out the difference between our approach and Labor's, that we're there to empower the individual. They're there to protect groups and and whatever. And I'd like to see us be more robust on welfare policy, for instance. We're always a bit nervous because we don't want to be seen as the mean party that just leaves people to their own devices, and that's certainly not so. But we should be the party that recognises the negative consequences of welfare and that what that does to people's dignity, and that the best thing to do is to help them find their own living, their own way.
And I think that's what a majority of Australians believe anyway. So it's not like we're trying, not that we've set ourselves an impossible task, that we're pushing the proverbial uphill. I don't think we are. I think the majority, at least, of Australians actually believe that that's the right way to help them advance. And very strongly of the view that, words you mentioned, words matter. I think words and language matter. And in sort of protecting some of our real estate, that's a bad word, some of our political value, which we have in these, certainly in that sort of, call it the freedom area, we should be robust in protecting our stake, and we should be robust in, I'm not against negative advertising. I'm not afraid of saying, well, you know, this is where the Labor Party, this is where Prime Minister Albanese came from. Do we really think they've jettisoned all that, or are they just conveniently showing one face to the election and then going back to their natural habitat afterwards?
In some senses, the Labour approach is an easy sell, isn't it? If you say, for instance, there's a problem with housing, young people can't get into housing, Labour will come along and say, we'll fix all that, we'll do social housing, whereas we can't put our hands on our hearts and say that as free market liberals. We know that there's a supply crisis in the housing, and we know at some point individuals just have to knuckle down and save for a deposit hard as it is. It would be easier, wouldn't it, if we could play the government can fix your problems line every
time?
Well,
yeah, I mean, you listen to Parliament, it's basically people say, oh, well, we've given more money for this, call it social housing, whatever it might be. I think, though, the important thing is that we not allow our political opponents to own some of those policy issues which are susceptible to, well, Labor's got the easy answer, or we're just going to spend money on it and it'll be right. Now, I always thought, a long time ago when I was in opposition and then in government, areas like the environment, I think I started the first Environment Protection Authority, the first EPA. And indeed, I started the first ICAC. Didn't turn out so well for me, but it was nevertheless, it's now been accepted everywhere by every state and in the Commonwealth. My point is that we sometimes allow a simplistic view that housing, for example, is a Labor area. And it's perfectly bloody obvious it's an area that's fundamental to everyone, whether they vote, Califumpian, Communist, Liberal, Labor. Perfectly obvious that housing, or indeed a view on the planet, the future of the environment, perfectly obvious it's not a natural ground for either party, but certainly not a natural ground for the people whose general answers are, more regulation and more spend more money and have more regulation. So, I that irked me then, and it still irks me a bit now, that we tend to think we've done our bit if we sort of federally. I think, the Integrity Commission, leave aside the details. Of course, if you've got Integrity Commissions in every state bar Tasmania, you wouldn't be a genius to think that there will be an Integrity Commission nationally. And surely it's better for our side, with our values about other things we're not talking about today, but our values on justice and so on, be better if we created the commission than if we allowed Labor to create it.
Yeah, absolutely. We might at least turn it into less of a kangaroo court. I'm absolutely in agreement with you on this, Nick. It frustrates me all the time that we go, well, that's education. Let's take education. Yeah. Education is Labour's strength, so we're not going to bother with that. So what happens is Labour get in, they design the policy, they come up with the Gonski scheme with all its unintended consequences and cost and unfairness, and then we get into government and just moan about having to pay for it. What about we actually came and said, well, we'll come up with a solid reform plan for education.
Yeah, and that's true of state and federal, and one of my regrets, if I can turn this partly into a confessional, we made an effort to start reform of the public school system, choice to parents and more performance assessment of teachers and more local control and various other things. And we didn't get the politics right. I'm pretty confident we got the policy right. So it's the same. It's the same thing. And here we are, long, 30, 40 years later. The Labor gets elected after 9, 12 years, and they say, "Oh well, the answer is to spend more money on public education, which, A, they really can't do because they haven't got the money, and B, it's not the answer. But we've got there by letting them... I often hear what you said. Sorry, that's a long answer. When I was federal president of the party, people would say, well, we can't win on health and education. We always win on the economy and security. Okay, that's got some, merit, some very similitude. But that doesn't mean that we should, that the answer is to ignore health and education, for example, or the environment.
Well, that's the big one. You put your finger on it with the environment, and again, this is something we're trying to turn our minds to. So we decide, we're not particularly, it's not a high priority for us or not a high enough, let's put that another way, we don't see the global warming challenge possibly as high a priority, so we let Labour do the work. And it's happened the world over. The left have really grabbed this, framed it, and set the parameters to it, right the way from the IPCC downwards, whereas when we put our minds to it, we could achieve the same ends probably quicker and more efficiently and without killing the economies.
Yeah, and I think our problems, we've always had problems with young people. It's the old thing about it. If you're not a socialist at 20 and a capitalist at 40, then you're sort of unusual. I think the environment is clearly an area where young people have, they're not worried about the economy as much for obvious, reasonable reasons, and they're very worried about issues surrounding the environment. So I think our political problem with youth, the youth vote, is partly because they're not necessarily as worried about the economy and national security as people that are older, and you understand, one understands why, and they are interested in health, education. They have a sense of how the poorer people being looked after and so on. So I think it ties the policy, the willingness to stand up for our values and our traditional core policies needs to be, we need to cover the field, we need to represent the community. We don't want to lose the young vote in any sort of systemic way. We need to get to the perfectly obvious conclusions that young people are interested in the environment, they're interested in other soft issues, if you like. And so again, I think the values, the policy, the sort of hard, slightly harder-edged core stuff is also good politics. It's not a thing to separate.
Yeah, and I think one thing we've recognised with these 17 we believe statements is they're far from definitive, and there's nothing in there, for instance, specifically about the environment, but that's understandable for the time it was written.
Exactly.
But if you're going to do it again today, clearly you have to address that subject, seeing as how it's not only of interest, but a really important issue for a lot of people, particularly younger voters.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean about context and needing to ensure that what we do with that set of thoughts, whether it's from the 40s or the 50s, set of thoughts, or whether it's FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he was somewhat time in the early 40s, I think, with some of his speech about freedom. We need to make sure that as society changes, and whether we always like it or not, but the world continues to change, and we need to be upfront about whether our thing fits, doesn't fit, why doesn't it fit, what do we do, or indeed where it's excluded. And you're right, the environment, I think, was never an issue in elections in the 1950s or indeed the 1960s. It's become an important issue over the last few federal elections, and we need to make sure, as I say, that we're proud of and stick to our our foundations, if you like. But we also need to be willing to adjust, change, where the context in which the policy works is different.
Let's go back to reflect a little bit on your time in government in New South Wales. One thing you did do was to start working out how you can use the power of the private sector to do what had previously been assumed was the work of the public sector. And I think that what you started has been carried through with great aplomb by the most recent Liberal government in New South Wales. We've got miles and acres of tunnels under the streets of Sydney to prove it. Tell me your thinking on that. Was that a very conscious thing that you just thought that the private sector is somehow more efficient? Or?
Well, I was interested. I started from the results, and I'm, I guess, proud of that. I think I still do that in my subsequent business career, or indeed in some ways when I was federal president of the party. You start from the outcome. The outcome was that we needed to do something about the fact that we had a long drought of public infrastructure, not just transport, but a lot of it transport related. And actually, there wasn't a lot of choice. If you didn't, I was interested in maintaining our credit rating, which they're busy trying to lose at the moment, and so on. So if you're interested in having a strong balance sheet, which you should, because at the end of the day, it's not the politician's balance sheet, it's the taxpayers, the people of the state. So I was interested in the strength of our, call it our balance sheet, of the state economy and the state government. And I was trying also to do something about the fact that we had, I think, probably not a freeway worth thinking about at the time. So other than perhaps the ones leading to the Harbour Bridge, which I can see behind you. So it wasn't just a philosophical, a feel-good thing. It was actually that it worked, that the private sector approach, or call it public-private partnerships, some people call it, is the foundation of what you describe. And you can see that both in the Greiner-Fay government and then in the O'Farrell and subsequent governments, that was when almost all the work happened. I can tell you this, and you can cut it out if you like. I was the chairman of one of the big construction groups after I'd left politics. And their German owners came, asked if they could see Bob Carr. Yeah, sure. And we went to visit the Premier, and he said, look, we absolutely believe that the private sector's the answer, because these people were involved across City Tunnel, whatever it might have been. And he said, oh, we believe in that. And he said, the public have accepted it. I got back from New York a day or two before the state election a few months ago, and of course here's Labor saying, well, take back into public ownership some of the assets, and we're never ever going to have various forms of privatisation. So it is just ironic that, again, we sort of do the hard work, and then Labor says, oh yeah, well, we manage and we'll take credit for some of it. And then when they're back in opposition, they revert to, well, you don't want to pay tolls. Well, of course you don't want to pay tolls, but you got to pay somehow. So you're either going to pay taxes or you're going to pay tolls. There's no other way on God's earth. So yeah, I'm very energized by that subject, and I have clear recollection of Carr saying that, oh yes, we, the Labor Party, have accepted, and the public in New South Wales have accepted that public-private partnerships for roads and other transport assets are a good idea. And then, of course, years later, they turn around and say, oh, it's terrible, it's a disaster, we're going to get rid of it.
But I think that comes back to your first response, which is it's a pragmatic matter. And it's not a case of being dogmatically for the private sector and against the public sector. In fact, you know, as you know, the O'Farrell and subsequent governments did some terrific work under Gary Sturgis of being able to find that right blend and actually encouraging an entrepreneurial atmosphere within a government department and to great effect.
Yeah, well, in fact, I think they never got the credit. Maybe Gary never got the credit for helping create a situation where the corrective services department, which was always a tough place to run for understandable reasons, Gary helped the incumbents, the public sector, win contests with the private sector in terms of improving the prison, the new prisons, or improving the old prisons. So yeah, and we've never been quite willing to take the credit for that. Yeah, because it has elements of perhaps difficulty in a marketing sense, and people really think, well, it sort of sounds like a private police force, and we really want the government to be running the jails. Well, the governments around the world have proved that they're not very well qualified in running prisons. And if you do the right thing, you can help them be better public sector managers. So yeah, of course it's pragmatic. Of course it's about the results. And you know, I think we're on the side of the angels in terms of the results from our beliefs. You've listed them a couple of times in this chat. I think the essentially individually and privately oriented policies have got a track record of success. But we tend not to defend them strongly enough or promote them strongly enough. I don't know how many people know of the work that was done with corrective services to help them beat various global
players.
Well,
I think the problem there, Nick, is that, I mean, I think that they relied on the customer experience to tell us that, say, the ferries are better or the trains are better or the, you know, Service New South Wales, you can get your driver's license much quicker. But of course, not too many of us are customers of the corrective service department.
So no, well, hopefully, department. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that is probably the reason. But it would have been a classic, maybe still is, but would have been a classic opportunity to say, look, you know, we are interested in running the prisons better, and here are all the criteria we use, some of which are about the experience for the prisoners, and we've managed to do that. And there's quite a large number of cases where the public sector, the corrective services department, has actually been the winner of genuine contests. And I think we could have promoted that success rather more effectively than we have.
Years back, possibly around the time you were in government, there was a lot of talk of small government. You know, we wanted small government. Big government was Labor thing, small government was ours. We don't seem to talk about it quite at those terms now, and I think probably that's for good reason, because in the end, isn't the important thing that you have effective and efficient government? It's not the actual size, it's whether it does its job well.
Yeah, I agree with that, and yeah, you're right. I mean, I think in that case we sort of, yeah, you go back to Reagan and he says, oh, government's the problem, not the answer. You know, that might in some points in history, whether it's in California or here or wherever, be right. But I don't think you start with the starting point isn't that government's the problem. You start with the belief that we've got these values and we look at how we're going to do stuff, and it will involve a combination. It inevitably involves a combination of public and private. And to say we should own that with more vigour than we have in the past, we've tended to be a bit scared of that. And I think that's a mistake, and it doesn't stop Labor, as we saw in New South Wales, try and use that, often successfully.
Before we finish, Nick, I'd like to go back to that statement, particularly the last clause So we stand positively for the Free Man, his initiative, individuality, and acceptance of responsibility. This, of course, is something, the word responsibility is something we should also always be associated with rights or freedoms. Mm. Right?
Yeah, well, it's the flip side of the same coin. And and again, I think that's happens to be another point where we're on the right side of whatever you want to be on the right side of history or politics or whatever, because of course responsibility, and I think the public, even when it applies to them, but the public tend, the punters, if you like, they tend to accept that responsibility is important, is valid, and we've tended not to go there, or we've tended to go there in a sort of punitive way. And you understand why governments want to run social services better and stop people cheating on their claims from government and so on. Of course one understands that, but I think that we need to take responsibility as a positive, as something which actually will improve the result, not only the result that we'll collect some more money or we'll stop some people cheating. That's hard to do, as we've seen in recent times in Australia. But responsibility is another virtue, and as I say, it's just the other side of the same coin that we're talking about. I think so. You know, if you're free to do things, you've also got to be responsible for doing them.
And that to me is why we're liberals and not libertarians. Yes. I mean, libertarians, it's quite a popular thing to be these days. You've only got to tune in Sky News any time after 7 o'clock and you'll see them in abundance. You know, the freedom, we're libertarians. Yeah. That's not good enough for me. I mean, we celebrate freedom as a libertarian would, but we're saying that is bound up with duties and responsibilities to our neighbours, to our community, even to the government, in the sense that, you know, we have certain obligations when it comes to jury duty and things we should perform.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I'm encouraging Jenny, who's sitting behind me in her office, who's going on jury duty tomorrow, which is frankly a pain for me, but it is part of the responsibility. And it's one of the areas we probably haven't, you know, at this time of rethinking of... I think we could probably have a responsibility focus as well as a freedom focus. And at times of change, of technology, of where the world of doing stuff, whether you're a private citizen or whether you're a government or a public servant, at this sort of time of really fast change and significant technological change, I think it's very salutary to think that responsibility is part of the answer, and I think we probably haven't done that well enough.
And I deliberately wanted to avoid COVID, but I can't help but mention one thing. One thing I was disappointed about, I think, not to pick out any particular government, but across the board, we didn't use that great resource which we've got, which is a people's willingness to do the right thing most of the time and to encourage people to look after their neighbours, to see if they were okay, to go around and visit with them food. That was never part of the rhetoric. It was always government's going to tell you to do this, and maybe that's something we should learn.
Yeah, I think, obviously I wasn't involved. I think COVID was a bad thing, not for the obvious public health reasons, it was that, but because it was so dramatic, because it sort of was unprecedented or wore the label of this is unprecedented, it gave the body politic, both the elected politicians, the ones in opposition and the public servants, a bit of a license to do stuff, because this was so bad, so new, so unusual, etc., that both the notion that you could spend whatever, and so everyone, it's not just Australia, it's around the world, you spent whatever and there was no sieve or no prism that you had to look through in terms of the quantity of spending. But on your point, that's also true. I think it was a bit easy to say that the government, the police force, the health, the public health officials, whatever. Well, this is so unusual, we've got to do it. And I think people who've had a go in some parts of the world, not that many, but who relied on people's innate goodwill, which I think Menzies would have thought about or talked about. Yeah, we probably just thought, well, yeah, here's a chance to throw the kitchen sink at this problem, and that's what we did, and I'm not sure we got the optimal result.
Just in closing, David Hughes, before I left the office, the executive director of the Menzies Research Centre gave me this quote to share with you. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, you only have power over people as long as you don't take everything away from them. When you've robbed a man of everything, he's no longer in your power. He's free again.
There is, that's very good. I haven't heard that, but it is. It helps make people realise what freedom is and what it means to individuals, which, as I say, in Australia, which has had freedom in a general sense for 100 plus years. I like the quote. I think it tells you that when you get people at a certain point, there's nowhere for them to go, and their freedom is valued, but it really ought to be valued across the spectrum.
Finally, just to return to the statement, we believe in the individual. We stand positively for the free man, his initiative, individuality and acceptance of responsibility. The question we ask at the end of every one of these, should we retain that clause, revise it, or reject it? I'm inclined to retain this one.
Well, so am I. I think it's so fundamental that there is nothing to be gained, in a sense, if you take that test. Sure, the context into which that applies and comes to work in 70 years on is different. But no, I wouldn't play around with it. I wouldn't amend it. But I would have the courage to take that in its traditional form, in its first form. And when things change, the environment we mentioned, then we can look at how this applies, how this fits. But I wouldn't change it.
Possibly one small amendment. We stand positively for the free man.
We might. Oh, I mean, we might change the gender for the free person, yes.
Or the free individual, perhaps.
Yeah.
But thank you, Nick. This has been a most enjoyable and rewarding conversation. I think we've covered a lot of ground. And thank you so much for bringing your perspective after many years of service to the Liberal Party and to your country and your state.
It's a pleasure. Nice to see you here.
Thank you. You've been listening to another Water Cooler Conversation brought to you by the Menzies Research Centre. We'd like to bring you many more, of course, and you can help us by subscribing from just $10 a month. Go to www.menziesrc.org/subscribe. I'm Nick Cater, and thank you for listening.